Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is Sister Awareness. In today's broadcast, we will be discussing African descendants' policy from emancipation to self-determination. We have a guest, Ozell Daniel, who will be calling in, who will be hosting a major conference for African descendants of the decade. We're going to have Africans from the continent, Africans from different regions in the world, from the Americas, from the inland of the United States. We're going to have a conversation, an internal dialogue about future policies and different things that affect us. So, right now, we're having technical difficulty, and I'm going to try to bring Brother Daniel in. So please bear with me. There are several articles in that are online that actually discuss our plight of how bad African descendants in the United States are really the shape that we're really in. One interesting article that I really always like to bring attention to is by the author's name is Joshua Holland, and this was written back in August 2016, and it describes the average Black American family. It's saying the average Black family would need 228 years to build the wealth of a white family today. Just as past public policies created the racial wealth gap, the current policy widens it. So we're looking at the policies. It states, if current economic trends continue, the average Black household will need 228 years to accumulate as much wealth as their white counterparts hold today. For the average Latino family, it will take 84 years, absent significant policy interventions or seismic change in the American economy. People of color will never close the gaps. So policy is very important. Programs are very important. What we have to do as a people is we have to look at several dynamics we have to take in consideration. Our current political configuration is based on dependency, is based on a relationship of exclusion and marginalism. We can change that. We can change that. And changing our political relationship . I have a caller, so let me bring them in. Caller, are you there? Did you press 1? A minute. Caller, are you in the host queue? I can't see you. Are you there? Caller, are you there? Caller, are you there? Can you hear me now? Press 1. For yes, you press 1, and it'll let me know that you're in the host queue. Press 1. Press 1, and it will let me know that you're in the host queue. Caller, are you there? Caller, are you there? Can you hear me?
Hi, can you hear me?
Greetings. Greetings. I can hear you.
Okay, we're finally through.
Yes. Well, it is such a good morning to discuss self-determination, and please tell the audience about the upcoming conference in Hawaii that you are organizing, and how it will help bring us together and unify us as a people.
Okay, what we are currently pulling together for April 25th through 29th in Honolulu, Hawaii, will be the first time there's ever been a Pan-African conference held in Hawaii. Malcolm X gave a speech called Message to the Grassroots. In his speech, he described something that happened in 1955 in Bandung, Indonesia. At that particular conference in Bandung, Indonesia, Africans and Asians met together to discuss ways they would recover from colonialism, how they would get the European foot off their necks. And so what we're hoping to do here in Honolulu is kind of replicate that to a degree. We have a large Asian population here. A lot of people may not realize how many black people are currently here in Hawaii. Most of us are here with the United States military, but we do have a bunch of us here actually from the continent and the Caribbean. I'm still hunting for my brothers and sisters from South America, but we do have a handful of us here. And so what we're hoping to do is kind of, you know, spur some dialogue that we don't typically have. Our current situation in the United States is we just tend to praise Jesus, talk about MLK, and vote Democrat. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with any of that, but, you know, if we're just kind of focused on these things right here, we're kind of missing a bigger picture of the billion people on the continent you know, the, you know, millions of people in South America and across the rest of the diaspora that we might not be connecting with and having the right kind of relationships and conversations with. We tend to look at each other as, you know, how black are we as to, you know, how much do they act like us, as opposed to, well, can we conduct business with these people? You know, so we're kind of stuck on, you know, the cultural stuff, but we're missing a huge, you know, bigger political and economic, you know, implication if we were able to work together. And so we're trying to spread that dialogue right there. We hear a lot about how the Chinese are in Africa, you know, building up. Well, they're over there doing that because we aren't.
That's true.
So, you know, yeah, we need to have that discussion there. You know, like, okay, you know, I don't think I've ever met a conscious Chinese person, but I know some Chinese people who are like, hey, you know, go to Africa, make money, get a girlfriend. You know, this is the conversation that I'm having here in Hawaii. You know, these people have friends and relatives who are looking at Africa as an economic opportunity. It just laid it out pretty plain. Go to Africa, make money, get a girlfriend. Okay,
sure.
Why aren't we taking a look at that? You know, the conversation that we'll have is, well, they're not woke, they don't like us, and it's like, well, no, that's home. You know, I think that accurate understanding of the African continent, our history to it, our history here in North America. And I think we need to, you know, go more into, you know, how accurate our history is. You know, when did we actually arrive in North America? How many of us, you know, are descended of slaves? You know, it's an uncomfortable conversation. But, you know, we do need to be honest about, you know, we need to be honest about our plight here. You know, you can't solve a problem.
And our
identity. One of the things that's kind of irritating the heck out of me right now is this whole people of color nonsense. I wasn't at that meeting. You know, I understand, you know, I'm from Detroit, but, you know, I have roots in Africa. You know, I don't know a color land. You know, I understand Ghana. I understand Congo, I understand Nigeria. So at one point, you know, my ancestors, these were Akan people. You know, these were Igbo people. You know, they were connected to that land. It wasn't just color land. You know, no, these were people who had nationalities and identities and language and cultures that we got robbed of.
Exactly.
You know, we don't want to romanticize it, but we do want to, you know, recognize and reconnect with that. I think another thing that we kind of overlook is just, you know, how willing we are to reconcile and forgive each other.
Exactly.
We'll renege in a hand of spades and cut a family member off for 8 years. A white person will kill us, and we're on TV crying, well, we need to forgive them and love them and all that. And, like, no, we need forgiveness for ourselves. You know,
do you think it's a mental issue? Do you think we as a people have mental issues? I think we have some serious collective psychological issues that have been not have been addressed. We suffer from fratricide, where it's so easy for us to kill each other, to do anything damaging to each other. But when it comes to acting collectively, we have a serious issue with it, and it's hurting us economically, politically, and it's also putting us in a place of genocide, if, you know, in my humble opinion. So I am so glad that you're having such a conference, and I would love to attend. If my funds permit, I will be definitely attending that conference, because it's a much-needed dialogue.
Yeah, it is. My situation is a little bit kind of different. Well, since I've been I got stationed in Hawaii in 1993, and I decided to stay here. The weather, it's nice, and, you know, talking to people who have met from the continent, they said this is, you know, Hawaii, it's similar to what they experience back home. So, and I just kind of felt comfortable here. But, you know, since I've been here, you know, I just kind of pay attention to how some of the different ethnic groups work out here. One of the things that you, if you come to Hawaii and spend any significant amount of time here, is you will hear white people complain about racism. It'll be the funniest stuff you've ever heard, but they will actually complain about racism out here. And so I watch, well, what are the different groups doing? And it's not necessarily so much that they hate white people, although they did have a thing called Kill Holly Day. I just noticed a lot of the discussion that we'll talk about group economics, I'm watching people actually practice it. And they're rather shameless about it, too. You know, it's, you know, you can go to Chinatown, and there's a reason it's called Chinatown. The Chinese, they own all of it. You know, you see the Mandarin and Cantonese lettering on the wall. You go to the bank, it's a Chinese-owned bank. You know, they literally own, the Chinese are the biggest landowners in Hawaii. You know, and so, you know, and I kind of look at the same thing kind of with the Japanese, Koreans, and Filipinos. Like, all the Asian groups come here, and, you know, they're very, it's very plain, you know, that you're just in a smaller version of their home countries. And so I've been out here 25 years just kind of observing this. I look at the indigenous people here, the Hawaiians, you know, we're, they're similar to us. You know, they were original black people that were here first, but they have enormous problems with infighting in their quest, you know, for self-determination and reclaiming, you know, their identity. What they do have is they, you know, do have Hawaiian immersion schools where they are reclaiming, you know, their culture. You know, they're reestablishing themselves as Hawaiian people. But for the life of them, you know, they can't seem to get it together to decide, you know, how they're going to, you know, reclaim, you know, their government. So there's competing Hawaiian sovereignty groups. And so one of the things I look at is, you know, I want to unify with them, but I also have to look at, you know, the situation that we are facing right now with a global economy. As far as infighting and not getting anything done, I think black people, we do that pretty well on our own. Fight against the Hawaiians, but, you know, they're doing the same things we're doing here. Well, let me look at another example here. Okay, well, Japanese people, Chinese people, they tend to stick together. Some people call it racist, but they look out for their best interest first. And these are the two groups that are actually outperforming white people academically, economically. When they come to the United States, you know, they open businesses. Japan, Korea, they actually have, you know, their car manufacturers in the United States. So we kind of have to take a hard look at that and figure out, well, what are they doing that we aren't? And,
well, I,
you know,
think,
there's an
I think one of the issues, caller.
I am still here. Mm-hmm.
Okay, one of the issues that I see with us is totally mental. I think because of the trauma, the physical violence, the mental violence, we've been attacked from all angles, economically. Through the medical system, through the school system, we have had so many acts of attrition geared towards us that we have actually become so traumatized that we actually have a fear of connecting. Because if you look at during slavery, when we tried to come together, they had laws on the books like Maritose Manumission. Dr. Claude Anderson talks about it in Powernomics and his book, Black Labor, White Wealth, how they had laws on the book that favored, that rewarded blacks who snitched on other blacks who was trying to get out of slavery. There's reward systems now put in place subliminally in different corporations and different settings that actually rewards that cutthroat behavior, internal cutthroat behavior that stops us from connecting. So what I propose that we do is that we start looking at traumatized groups such as the Jews, who underwent historical trauma and how they survived. They had a cultural continuity. What did the Vietnamese do when they suffered such trauma at the hands of really the colonialists? They divided whole countries. So I think a thorough study of colonialism and its impact on its victim psychology and how they overcame that, that's what we need to start looking at. What happened in Algiers? You know, I love Frantz Fanon, reading his work. What happened there? How did those people overcome colonialism? What did they do to fight it? How did they come together? Because colonialism divides people. It has to have that fragmentation for that hegemony to exist. I think Asian countries are more resistant towards that, or people are resistant toward that, because they have that uninterrupted cultural continuity. They fought colonization. China fought tooth and nail colonization, not only one time, but two times. The Japanese, they fought, as a matter of opinion. They had a strong cultural network, the reason why they were able to overcome such trauma. So we need to look at how did the survivors of colonism and such trauma, how is it did they maintain their sanity, their collective sanity, in order to be as prosperous as they are today? And I yield the floor back to you.
One of the things that is going to be very, very difficult and probably upsetting to a lot of people is kind of looking at spirituality and religion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're a deeply spiritual people, but I think sometimes that's kind of crippling, and it doesn't allow us to fully heal and, you know, develop, you know, the self, and to develop some self-confidence. You know, we're waiting, you know, for some invisible hand in the sky while we have, you know, very able-bodied people right here on Earth. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's a really touchy subject right there, but, you know, one of the things we have to look at is, you know, our reliance or trying, I don't know, so that's one of the things we're going to have to look at, you know, because I look at other groups, they have their spirituality, they have their religious groups, but they also have, you know, a supermarket, you know, and I think one of the things that we do entirely too much is we build church and we look at church for everything, and, you know, we have to have some of us saying hi. You know, it's okay to be a mechanic and open a garage.
Mm-hmm,
it's okay
mm-hmm.
to be a plumber and work with my hands, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with being a plumber. With the whole way that we look at education and the prestige behind it, you can have a degree in ethnic studies, you know, all day, and you can discuss philosophical terms and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, the end result is, you know, it doesn't really produce tangible goods. It doesn't, you know, get a farm going. It doesn't get a farming cooperative going. It doesn't create a transportation system. And so these are the kind of, you know, things that I have to look at, you know, being in Hawaii, where our black population is so tiny, you know, I do have to depend on other ethnic groups for everything that I need, just because we're so remote. And so even if my immediate circle is all black, you know, we don't own any farmland out here. So we have to fly our food in. Even looking at some of the things that I'm attempting, you know, with my little side business ideas, you know, if I wanted to do something as simple as sell hamburgers.
How is the fishing industry? How is the – because one thing that our organization is looking at, we're looking at asserting our rights from all the way from our indigenous rights up to decolonization. And we have rights to the sea. That's what's so good about you being located in Hawaii, is that you can get into distribution. But there should also be a fishing industry. Black people, especially in the South, we love some fish and we love shellfish. So if we assert our indigenous rights, we have rights to the sea. We have a right to fish. So that's a whole economy right there just for the blacks in Hawaii.
There's so much potential out here. You know, I'm trying to make people aware of it. The cost of living is kind of steep, but you know, I'm looking if other groups are able to do it, we can too. Deep sea fishing, there is money to be made out here doing that. You know, yeah. So we're out in the middle of the ocean, and Japanese people, they love seafood. That seafood is a huge, huge, you know, staple of their diet right there. And you know, so yeah. So there's we're literally out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, so we've got fish all over the place. You know, there's no reason that you can't come out here. There's no reason a group of Africans should not look into trying to come out here and catch some of these fish out here. You know, that's money just sitting in the ocean right there. You know, if you go out there and catch it.
And also the algae and different medicines and supplements are being made from seaweed and different microbes in the ocean as well. I'm taking some right now that has done wonders for me because I've had an energy issue. And one of my sisters, Sister Cecile, she sent me some stuff made out of seaweed and shellfish. And I'm not going to lie to you, I feel so much better. My energy level has increased. So with that being said, there's so many avenues that we can pursue, but we have to have a political organ that manages our human capital, our wealth, our resources, and our land territory of where we are, because we have different international and human rights that will allow us to secure the political and legal avenues we need to grow and to develop. And I think that's one of the major problems that we have, is that we don't have a political organ that represents our interests and our interests first. Right now, the political relationship that we have with the United States is one of unjust enrichment on behalf of the United States. We had an economy. We had a land base. We had territory specifically here in the South because it was given to us during the Civil War. And over the years and in increments, it was absorbed. Okay, another thing that happened to us is that the United States re-encapsulated us into their polity, using our human capital to fight their wars, to reinforce their hegemony in the world, reinforce that white supremacy here on the ground, and to exclude and marginalize us. So right now, based on some studies that I've seen, we are in genocidal conditions because, A, we don't feed ourselves, B, we depend on the very people who want us dead, and C, we have no clue that we're in a boiling pot. So one thing that I'm looking forward to at your conference is hammering out our place in the world, our political relationship with Asians, with other Africans, with the Polynesians, people in the Pacific. From what I understand, the last time I visited the UN, the Polynesians, who are our distant cousins, they are exercising self-determination. They are recouping their resources. They are moving forward to taking back different aspects in their lives that's going to help the survival of the next generation. So those are some avenues we can pursue. We need to be building allegiances among each other internally, as well
right.
as with those Asian groups, instead of looking at them as our enemies. China, I don't see China as my enemy. I don't see a Japanese people as my enemy. As a matter of fact, if you do the research, the Japanese have always been our ally. People don't know that, but the Japanese were our ally when we didn't have a friend. We had one. That is why they dropped that bomb on Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
That is why.
Yeah, and so I've just been kind of out here for the past 25 years, just kind of immersed in Asian cultures, and so kind of my approach to being a Pan-Africanist, I've just taken a very Asian approach to things, and so it just started to ask, I had to boil everything down to three pretty simple questions of, what do we own, what do we produce, and what legislative agendas are we pushing? So I break it down to those three questions right there. Because among Black people, we'll talk about, well, I'm a Christian, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Freemason, I'm part of the Divine Nine group. Okay, so between all of whatever organizations you belong to, well, what do you guys own? Collectively, what do you own? So out here in Hawaii, I look at, the Mormon Church. They own the town of Laie. They own Brigham Young University, Hawaii, and the Polynesian Cultural Center. So they've got a whole town out here where, they can be Mormons and they have no alcohol and everything shuts down at 9, and they're running the show out there. They own land. They're educating and employing, themselves out there. And so I'm looking at, okay, as individuals, we have companies doing this here, but as a collective, well, really, what do we own? Oh, not much. Okay, so what do we produce? We need a manufacturing and agricultural base. We have
That's
individual
true.
farmers, we have some individual factories, but collectively, we're still dependent as heck on, on others.
That's
We need
true.
more
That's
of us
true.
to do this stuff right here.
That's true.
And so,
And you know what? I was doing some research over there on emerging nations, and I was looking at, okay, I'm because you know we created a confederated nation state, and everybody's welcome to join. We don't have a bias against Muslims, a bias against anybody practicing Hinduism or whatever in Hindu. All we ask is that you understand is the condition that we're in, and that you are an African descendant, and we chose that identity as a descendant, an African descendant.